Hello, welcome to episode 2A, the second episode of the Gambling Files, RTFM, read the fucking manual, where we are joined by our first guest today, Jennifer Gaynor of J. Gaynor Law in Las Vegas. Jennifer's bringing us up to date on what is going on in Nevada. And apparently, the news is all good. Hello, Jennifer.
Right now. Hello, thank you for having me.
There's still room for it all to go. Do you know what I haven't done? And I feel like a very bad person now. I didn't mention that Fintan is here as well. Hi, Fintan.
Finally, I get the recognition I deserve. I'm sitting, I'm devastated. Not only have you just completely confused the numbering system, 2A, whatever that means, and then you just ignore me like I'm nothing. I'm devastated, John. Devastated. We'll have a talk offline about this afterwards. I'm really not happy.
I'm sorry, Fintan. I'll make it up to you. I'll tell Santa.
Good.
So, Jennifer, what's the current state of play in Las Vegas? Everything's open for play. It's bouncing back and everybody's happy and nobody's ill?
Pretty much. I mean, certainly people are still ill, but overall, Las Vegas has recovered in an amazing way. You know, it's quite a rebound. Like last year in 2020, our gaming revenue was the lowest we'd had since 1996 at $7.87 billion. And that was a 35% drop from 2019. In 2021, we are setting new records. In fact, in July, we set a new record for gaming revenue of $1.36 billion. And that was following a record previously set in May of $1.23 billion. So definitely on the road to recovery.
What's driving the records? Is it like there's nothing else to do in America, or just something specific to Las Vegas?
Just desperation.
I think it is a tinge of desperation. I think you hold people up, you keep them from being social for so long, and they're eager to get out there. And I think Las Vegas, as you know, is the world's adult playground. So everyone wants to come.
So we can say Vegas is back. Is that the headline we're going to go with?
Yes. And, and I'll say that tentatively. We're definitely back right now. Of course, there could be new variants that come out and, cause new spikes and make them decrease occupancy levels or stuff like that could happen. But, we're taking a lot of precautions to make sure that we don't become a super spreader destination and that people feel safe to come here. In fact, if you look at the visitor volumes, it's looking pretty good. So it's kind of been a roller coaster. So in 2020, we were having record volumes. In February, we had 3.3 million visitors, and then COVID hit. So it dropped off from there. March, 1.5 million visitors. April, 196,000 visitors. So in 2021, that's been ramping back up. In January, we were back to 1.29 million visitors. July, 3.3 million. So now we're back to where we were at the beginning of 2020 before this all happened.
Gaming floors are all kind of running at maximum capacity, yeah?
They are, but they've been reconfigured. There's plexiglass between machines. Machines are spaced out. It's not quite, what it used to be, but it is pretty back to normal. You look at the gaming tables and people are surrounding them. People are walking around. The slot machines are full. So, yeah.
It's sort of like a blackjack table, something like that, where you've got, pretty close seating. And let's not beat about the bush. I've seen some very fat people sitting at blackjack tables. So people are in quite close proximity then, and they're all happy?
They are. Well, what the Gaming Control Board and the governor have done along the way is they reduced the number of seats you could have at, say, a poker table or a blackjack table, and I think that's still in place.
So it's not quite as
mushy as it used to be.
Yeah. Are the buffets still closed?
I believe the buffets are open again. And in fact, you'll be very happy to know, as of May 1st, 2021, the topless clubs were allowed to reopen.
It's a relief. I've got to be honest with you.
Those poor girls.
I've been worrying about them.
Yeah, me too.
I think one of the clubs actually tried to do a drive-through lap dance model. I don't know how that worked.
That is enterprising.
I'm Googling it right now.
I went to Hooters in Vegas. I thought it was an owl sanctuary. You can imagine my surprise when I walked in the door and there were no owls.
Shocking.
He's been saving that joke for ages. He's just been sitting on it, ready to go with that one.
Years and years and years. Go on, Fintan.
Okay. So what other changes have happened on the gaming floor? So some of the things I've heard about it is like moving away from cash to card payments, and has it kind of accelerated some other trends that were probably actually good for the consumer?
Absolutely. I think it did accelerate some things that were probably going to come eventually anyway. So, you know, some permanent changes I think we'll see even after COVID has kind of passed would be, you know, improved cleaning and sanitization, you know, in the hotel rooms. So back at the beginning of COVID, one hotel employee got sick from COVID and died. And so the hospitality industry union sued the properties for failing to protect their workers from COVID. So in response to this, the state passed a law to protect workers and businesses, and some of the things that they've put in place are a minimum of 6-foot social distance between workers and guests, mandatory COVID testing for employees, daily temperature checks, and paid time off for workers who are waiting for test results, and required cleaning in rooms. And this includes TV remotes, touch screens, light switches, things that you might not have seen before. And if you do this, businesses in Nevada can't be sued if they follow. They can't be sued by their employees for not protecting them if they follow these protocols.
I didn't realize that the remote wasn't something that was cleaned. I won't be licking one of those again. I want to come back to the litigation thing in a second, but first one quick question about hotels. Is occupancy, I mean, is it full occupancy? I mean, I don't mean are they full, but I mean, could they be full?
I think so. I think they're back in the, you know, because Las Vegas properties are generally around, you know, 94-95% occupancy at all times. And I don't know that I've checked the occupancy figures, but given the visitor volumes that we've been seeing, I would assume that they're pretty high.
Okay. It's just, you know, just the potential to all the rooms are open is what I'm trying to say. I think I'm just saying it quite clumsily.
They are. And, you know, I wanted to circle back to Fintan's point about changes on the casino floor. I think I forgot to mention a few things beyond what the state put in place to protect workers. There have been other changes on the casino floor that I think will be permanent. An increase in online reservations, touchless payment systems, self-check-in kiosks, and enhanced Wi-Fi for, you know, people who want to do staycations or work from their hotel rooms in Vegas while they play at night.
That's quite a welcome change, because there's plenty of very nice properties in Las Vegas that have crap Wi-Fi.
Not anymore.
That's actually quite a big deal, because people do choose their hotels based on things like what's the Wi-Fi like. There's one place in Vegas where I'll never stay again because the showers were so bad. Seriously, it was that bad. And I stayed at this property like twice, I think. And the first time you're like, yeah, I've just got a room with a crap shower. No, they're all crap. We touched on something in the TLDR. What's the status of immunization? Not just for employees in hospitality and in the casinos. Is it something people are hungry for? Is there a big take up? Is there a lot of resistance? No pun intended. What's going on with immunization?
I think you're seeing it across the country. There are, you know, a lot of people who jump to get the vaccination, you know, because we want to move past this. But there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy. There's a lot of misinformation being spread on the internet, about how vaccines are harmful, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think you're always going to get that the anti-vaxxer movement. But as of now, as of actually Friday, September 10th, 53% of eligible Nevadans 12 and over are fully vaccinated. And if you look at folks who have gotten one shot, I think that's a lot higher.
That's a lot higher than I was expecting you to say.
And have the casinos like mandated this the same way as some of the airlines have, where if employees have to be vaccinated if they want to keep their job, or is it more voluntary in Vegas?
Not at all voluntary. Employees have to be vaccinated or they have to have weekly COVID tests.
Got it. And does the employee pay for the COVID test, or is it a free test?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure.
Because I know in Germany, they actually stopped the free testing to force more people to get vaccines, because a lot of people were just getting the weekly free test as a way to avoid the vaccine.
Well, and I think another issue with the tests, even if they are free, which I think they might be, we saw this with the teachers at our schools here in Nevada. You know, if they weren't vaccinated, they had to get the weekly tests, but the sites they were sent to had long, long lines, so they might be waiting 3 hours, you know, out in the sun for a test. So I think that was a disincentive.
Got it.
Speaking of COVID testing, I had to take two of my children to be COVID tested yesterday. And as a drive-through, I guess American style, drive-through testing in the UK. And there's one in the town, just by the town where they live. So we went over there and I had the three kids in the back and their mum was at work. And it was about 2 hours by the time we left. I mean, doing the test in the car yourself, etc., you know, it's a quick thing. Unless they're my children. And it took 1.25 hours to do the first one. It took about 20 minutes to do the second one. And then I accidentally put the slip of paper with the registration information on inside the biohazard bag and sealed it. So then we had to go through getting new barcodes, etc. So, you know, it would have been about 1.5 hours, 1 hour and 40 minutes. I managed to put it up to 2 hours. It was very warm. It was a horrible experience. So I feel for those people that were waiting in line. I've got lived experience. Sorry, there's no funny story. I had a shit morning.
Was that today?
That was yesterday. I got the results today. The kids are all fine. So not only that, but they wasted my time.
Well, that's good news.
I suppose. So you mentioned about litigation. Mm-hmm. Although, did you mention that on TLDR or was that on this episode? Has anybody attempted to sue a property for allegedly catching COVID while there, whether it's a guest or an employee? What's the status with, because you said it, if properties take certain steps, then they can't be sued
by their employees. Right. So back in June 2020, you know, at the start of all of this, there was unfortunately a hospitality worker who got COVID, presumably from his job at a casino and died. And so the Las Vegas Strip Hospitality Workers Union filed suit against a number of casinos for failing to protect their workers. And right, we had the law put into place that if casinos meet these minimum standards of cleaning and testing and et cetera, you know, steps taken to protect their workers, they can't be sued by the workers. I think that just covers employees. Whether patrons can sue, I'm not entirely sure. I certainly haven't heard about it. So if they have, it's been, you know, handled quietly.
Okay, America being America and the view of America from the outside, you know, if you look at somebody a little bit funny, you're going to get sued.
Yes, we are very litigious.
You love that. And you've only got to drive down the freeway in Vegas. I mean, everything is an advert from a lawyer, you know. Being bitten by a badger? Call us.
Yes, and they have jingles and, you know, catchy commercials where they're like, you know, giants walking through a miniature city, you know, stomping out, you know, the people who have hurt you and getting you, you know, hefty verdicts. Yes.
I wonder if there's an element of nominative determinism in some lawyers' specialisms then, in order to have the best jingle. So say you're a lawyer and your name is John Pace, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm John Pace, attorney at law. What am I going to specialize in? Hey, if you've been shot in the face, call John Pace.
Oh, that's good. That's good. You know, someone might use this after they hear it.
But you could change your name as well, though. So you could, like, you don't even have to be limited by your own
surname. Oh, yes.
Right. So, you know, you're driving down the freeway. There's, you know, the Better Call Saul type poster. It's Hercules von Rockstar. And he's going to be your lawyer. And, you know, you could have so much fun with the names. Like, well, why hold yourself back?
Exactly. And John, I realize we'd been talking earlier about the changes on the north end of the strip. So I wanted to touch on that as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in talking about Vegas recovery, I mean, it's not just, I want to say that I feel for SLS because SLS just happened too early.
The Sahara, you mean?
Yes, sorry. SLS, as was, happened too early. If that had opened around the same time as Genting, they would have probably had a great time. But you've got Sahara, you've got the Strat's been refurbed, and it looks like they've done a really nice job there.
Mm-hmm.
Genting's opened. You know, the north end of the strip is, like, potentially pretty cool now.
Coming alive. And also you had the convention center expansion, which takes it straight from Paradise, where it is, all the way to the strip. And that's on the north end as well. And of course, in 2023, we're going to have the Sphere open, which should be a very interesting venue.
What's that all about then?
So it's a unique venue. It's like a giant ball, a giant sphere set up, and it's going to have, LED screens and sound systems like you've never seen. Apparently the way it's set up, the technology they're using, you'll be able to feel the sound when you're you know, viewing things or experiencing things. I think you can't just view and listen. I think you just experience in the sphere. So and it will have, like, the lights and the light shows on the outside of it, the projections on the outside of it as well. So it should be pretty exciting.
So where's that going to be located?
That is right behind the Venetian.
Okay. So that's reasonably central then.
Central, but towards the north end. You know, I consider the north end, you know, kind of the Venetian Treasure Island up. So, you have Resorts World, Wynn, Encore, the Stratosphere, mm-hmm. you know, those Mirage, Treasure Island, those properties. And I think one other thing that the north end of the strip is doing well as well is they have free parking and valets. So all of the resorts I just mentioned, the Wynn, the Encore, Sahara, Stratosphere, Venetian, Palazzo, all have free valet.
Are you saying that the properties on the south end of the strip don't have free valet?
That's correct.
That's strange, isn't it? I don't know where to start with that. Because one thing I wanted to talk to you about was what, pre-COVID, a lot of places had taken free valet off or had gone back to a charging model for valet parking.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of people were kicking off about it. But you would think that in trying to encourage people to come back, everybody would have moved back to free and just be, yeah, come back, enjoy it. It's great to see you again. But actually what I've been seeing is that more and more places are going back to the, but I didn't realize that the north end of the strip was parking nirvana.
It is. It's parking nirvana. And maybe it's just the way the strip is set up and that the south end of the strip, you know, has more dense cluster properties and they don't need to, you know, offer that to compete. Perhaps that's what it is. You know, a lot of visitors, you know, they drive and they park if they're staying at a hotel and they never drive again. So perhaps the north on the strip is attracting more locals traffic because that's really who's, peeved about the charge for parking. You know, I myself have not gone to the south end of the strip driving, you know, unless it was for a specific event since they started charging for parking.
I've got to be honest, I'm still thinking about what I could change my name to be a lawyer in Las Vegas. That's just, you've opened a real can of worms there, Fintan.
Sorry, man. It's all my fault.
I can see you on a billboard now.
Wow.
It's a jingle. It'll be the jingle because you can do the voices. So I think there's a lot of playroom there with that.
This is going to have an episode to itself.
Yeah, lawyers in America, it's an interesting thing.
I've always said there aren't enough.
Enough lawyers? Oh, God, I think there are way too many lawyers. It feels like everyone I know is a lawyer. Perhaps that's because I am one. I know my son. I was like riding to, you know, driving him to school in the car. And, you know, he saw a billboard for a lawyer and, you know, he was talking about lawyers. He's like, isn't everyone a lawyer? And I was like, no, son, no, not everyone is a lawyer.
My kids were asked what their daddy did when they were at school when they were very, very young. And they told their teachers that their daddy baked cakes on an aeroplane.
Oh.
Yeah, I have no idea where they got that from.
I'm like, please explain. I can't understand where that's coming from.
No, I just assume they're all a bit, you know, a bit behind with their learning.
But on the range of jobs they could have made up, you've got to be relieved with baking cakes on an airplane. It could have been any. They could have come up with anything, John. It could have been. You could have been called into the school for a big conversation. It could have been way worse. A sit down and a chat about your behavior.
This day wouldn't be the first time, let's be fair. The recovery is going well. Gaming revenues are looking really good. The properties are and have been working hard. I mean, you can't not give properties that size credit for putting in a monumental effort to just be able to be open. Is the situation, in your opinion, Jaina, for the recovery to continue just carry on as you are, or you know, is there more that can be done? I don't know, you tell me, you're the expert.
You know, I think the way things have been going, everyone would say carry on as we are. You know, it seems to be working. We're not seeing major outbreaks. Customers are feeling secure about coming back. I mean, there's still some issues. I mean, it's not all, you know, wine and roses, so to say. Because international travel is still not what it was, you know, we're not seeing that the Asian high rollers, I think that's impacting, you know, properties that cater to that market, like the Wynn and the Encore in particular, are seeing a drop in that area. And also business travelers, you know, still, you know, when I'm on conference calls and we're talking about people traveling, you know, coming to Vegas to visit, they're still not getting the green light from their companies to do business travel. So, you know, the convention business is still not quite where it was. I think it's going to take a little while for that to come back, for companies to feel safe sending their employees out to conferences.
Is this why things like the UFC then become really important? Because, you know, they had some major events over the last few months where they've brought in a lot of, I would assume, a lot of tourists into Vegas. Is that a fair assessment, or am I just completely wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I can't forget to mention the Las Vegas Raiders now in our second season.
Go Raiders.
Go Raiders. And yeah, well, you know, we saw a flurry of construction that continued, you know, during the pandemic, the Sphere, which I already talked about, Resorts World, obviously, and of course, Raiders Stadium. What used to be the Hard Rock Hotel is now, you know, Virgin. And that's another, you know, new casino opening or refurbishment, so to say. And the Golden Knights, the Las Vegas hockey team, is still incredibly popular. So these sports venues are incredibly important to bringing tourism to Las Vegas. And I think they're also talking about bringing in a Major League Baseball team at some point.
It's probably about time, to be fair. I mean, I don't think we've seen the massive rise in match fixing, etc., that the loss of PASPA's, you know, I don't think it's been the chaos that everybody thought it possibly could be. You just mentioned Virgin, actually, which is interesting. I'd forgotten about Virgin. It's nothing personal, Virgin. As Fintan will attest, I'm a little forgetful today. Have the opening numbers for Virgin and Resorts World been basically on track, or have they been a little disappointing? Has there been any talk?
You know, I haven't heard if they've been on track or been disappointing. That's a good question. Given the overall visitor volume, you know, in the recovery back to pre-COVID levels, I'd say they're probably pretty good.
Well, I feel bad for asking now.
But I do want to touch on the sports betting, you know, the spread across America with the fall of PASPA. You know, I think a lot of people thought that would hurt Las Vegas in term of, you know, we're no longer the only place you can go to have sports betting. And, you know, I and others who, you know, do gaming for a living, you know, said from the beginning, no, that is not the case. You know, a rising tide lifts all ships. It's just going to create more sports bettors, you know, across the nation, more people who are familiar and comfortable with sports betting. And that's definitely been the case because, you know, we've had the record gaming revenues that I mentioned in Las Vegas, and that included record sports betting revenues. In July of this year, we had $33.3 million in sports betting revenues, and that is a new record for Las Vegas. And, you know, so I think, you know, sports betting across the country, and it's only also good for match fixing, you know, because if you have a regulated industry with people watching it and communicating, I think you're more likely to see if there's strange patterns of betting that might indicate there's match fixing afoot.
Yes.
On the online casino kind of growing Vegas, what jumped out to me was the recent Wynn TV ad campaign with Ben Affleck and Shaq and all the celebrities. And it was as much an ad for their Las Vegas casino as it was an ad for their online casinos. And I really saw I thought it was actually one of the smartest ads I've seen, because it really kind of just went hand in hand in terms of building on the Vegas legacy and introducing the online brand. And then obviously all the celebrities and the little cameos and guest appearances they had was kind of also a real nod to Vegas, in my view, in terms of, this is where the celebrities hang out, come play with us. So I have to just totally agree with it. It grows the pie, and it just makes the entire industry bigger for everybody.
It does. And, you know, sports betting, it's always been kind of an amenity that we, you know, casinos in Las Vegas offer for their customers. It's not a revenue driver. Like if you look at the July revenues, yes, $33.3 million record sports betting revenue, but that's out of $1.36 billion total, of which $873.7 million of that was slots revenue. So slots, you know, and table games, which were $468 million, you know, that's still the driver of revenues in Las Vegas. It's not sports betting.
Yeah, you say that, but that's going to change. And I say that because newer properties are putting more focus on sports betting. And so when they're built, it's not a room in the back. It's not, you know, a tucked away thing. It's big screens. It's great signage, really, really good signage. Look at Circa. What would you say the two main focuses of Circa are? Well, there's the incredible pool setup, but the sportsbook setup is unique. It's massive.
Absolutely.
There's going to be a renewed focus on sports betting, in my humble opinion, in properties as they're built now. It's all going to change.
I think that's true. You know, now that it's rolled out nationwide and we have people learning about sports betting and getting comfortable with it, like I said, I think it is going to be a bigger part of gaming in Las Vegas. But I think it will be years before it overtakes, you know, the floor games, the slots.
No, I'm sure you're right. I was very surprised a few years ago when, hang on, Fintan, do you follow football?
Which one?
Real football.
You mean soccer or American football?
Well, I'm Irish, so we've also got Gaelic football. Oh, so in Ireland, we also call
it. And you're married to an Australian, so you also have Aussie rules football.
Yes.
And NRL, don't forget that.
Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah. soccer, association football.
I don't. I'm sorry.
Okay. So a few years ago, I don't know if you heard about this, Leicester City won the Premier League.
Yes.
At, odds at the start of the season were 5,000 to 1. And that spring, so the football season in the UK runs from August to May, pretty much. And I went over to Vegas in, I think it was late March, early April. As soon as people heard my accent, they would come over to me, total strangers, and say, do you think Leicester City can do it? It'd be the first thing out of their mouth. Do you think Leicester City can do it? Not even, hey, you're English. Do you think Leicester? No preamble. But their knowledge of English football was absolutely astonishing. I mean, these guys were really, really clued up. And I know the English Premier League is possibly the biggest sports brand in the world of its type. But it the archetype of the American sports fan is they only like American sports. That was very much not my experience.
Have you watched Ted Lasso, the new Apple TV show?
I have. I've seen the first series. I haven't seen any of the second series yet. It was wonderful.
Absolutely. It's just charming is the only way I can describe it. It's such a lovely show.
It's like you don't want it to finish and you want to know what happens to everybody after the credits roll.
Yeah.
Beautiful experience.
For those that haven't watched, it's an American football coach and his assistant who moved to England and take over a bottom of the league soccer team. So it's very, very well done. Very funny.
With Jason Sudeikis.
Correct. Yeah.
Who's fabulous in the title role. What I'm trying to say is there's a market there for sports betting in the US far, you know, it's not, I know everybody pays attention to when the NFL season is, and that's going to be when all the big bets are. But actually the World Cup, the European Championships, all of those things are going to keep sports betting buoyant in the US, the Copa America, et cetera, because the massive number of Spanish speakers in America, the massive number of people that are of South American descent, all of these things are going to mean sports betting grows and grows and grows.
Absolutely.
In my humble opinion.
I think it will grow. You know, one other thing I think that is kind of not a hit on sports betting, but keeps it from being like the massive revenue driver that slots or floor games are is, you know, sports betting is the only form of gambling where the house doesn't have an automatic edge. The house is truly active in the wager. So, you know, the house can lose, you know, so you need to manage it and make sure that you're managing the wagers. You know, the ideal scenario is that you take even wagers on both sides of the match. So, you know, the house is just moving money from one side to the other while collecting their big or their rake. So, you know, you need to have good management and people who are really astute, you know, setting your lines in order to make sure you make a profit.
I think it's very worth mentioning as well, looking at the moves of American gambling companies, specifically Caesars and MGM, both of whom, one of them succeeded, one of them hasn't yet, in securing the services in terms of sportsbook of British companies that have a history of retail betting. So what we would in the UK, we would call a traditional bookies, a traditional bookmakers, a turf accountant, etc. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Caesars, obviously, I mean, it's been all over the news recently.
Oh, yeah. Right.
But William Hill had a significant amount of interests on the strip, not just Caesars properties, but they were running them as a third party. You know, it was like a licensed sportsbook thing because they had the expertise, they had the odds setting expertise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all of the skills. And, you know, obviously they've done that deal. MGM tried to buy, was it Entain MGM tried to buy? And the reason that they tried to buy them is those skills that exist within the company, because the sports betting side in the US is just going to go through the roof and through the roof and through the roof again. They're just going to have to keep building new roofs. So the business to be in the US is either sports betting or roof building.
Well, all they have to do is just bring back the offshore sports betting back onshore, right? That's, you know, that's step one. There's a massive business already offshore. Would be my guess. Yeah. Apart from encouraging you, like all the deals with the NFL and stuff, and introducing it to more people.
What do you mean, Fenton?
And that's why, in my view, the state by state regulation is so important, because so much of it's still not in America.
Right, right. And, you know, I will point out that it's illegal for those offshore books to take wagers from Americans. So, you know, it's good that we are having the state by state regulation. I think right now there's 31 states that have legalized it, with about 22 of them actually have active sports wagering, and more are coming online every day. I think Arizona just came online a few days ago, for example.
Good knowledge. Jennifer, thank you very, very much for joining us today. We very much appreciate your insights on Nevada and telling COVID to go and fuck itself. And Jennifer is our resident expert on all things Las Vegas. So we will hopefully speak to her again very soon. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Our second guest on this episode of RTFM is Alex Barta, a director of Black Bow, an online retailer specializing in vintage watches, and author of the very beautiful book, The Watch, A 20th Century Style History. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Would you mind sharing with our listeners your credentials?
Sure. I started my watch career at Sotheby's joined them in 1996 and worked with them until 2009, predominantly in London, but also for 3 years in Geneva. And in 2009, I left to set up my own business, but I still work as a consultant for them and for a few other companies as well.
And it's reasonable to say, I mean, I've bought a couple of copies of your book, which I've given as gifts to people, and it really is beautiful. And I do urge anybody listening to this to look it up.
Thank you.
And it's out of stock on Amazon. So if you go onto the Black Bow site and buy it, Alex has some signed ones in his shop. You heard it here first. We don't have a discount code.
But we'll put the link in the notes underneath so you can find it straight away.
That too. So it's reasonable to say, Alex, you are a watch expert. We were talking on TLDR about what I perhaps cheekily described as, excuse me, a novelty watch, the Drake roulette watch. And you were explaining to us about the I can't remember the phrase that you used, the was it the quartz crisis?
That's right, yeah.
Which, you know, I didn't even know was a thing, but it was a really, really big deal. Part of the reason that I wanted to get you on was to talk about the watch as, and I am going to put this very crudely, as the modern subtle pissing contest. Because sort of in modern society, overt displays of sort of machismo are not cool, shall we say. And so I think kind of that aspect of the male ego has kind of gone underground a little bit. And I have a hunch and a theory that it's manifesting itself in the wristwatch. I mean, I've seen wristwatches that you could have probably served a pizza off. They're so big. And when we were discussing this just before we start recording, you actually said, well, hang on, the wristwatch has kind of nearly always been that. Could you tell us a bit about the history of the watch as a pissing contest?
So I suppose, yes, I mean, certainly when you look right back at the beginning of the watch, and so nobody knows when exactly the first watch was made. And of course, we're talking about pocket watches and the first watches. But we're talking certainly around 1530-ish is when we think the first watches appeared. And at that time, they were, you know, incredibly inaccurate. And there was a sort of transition from a table, effectively a small table clock, getting smaller and smaller, being spring driven, so that you can move it around from one room to another. So there's a sort of blurring of the lines of when a clock becomes a watch at that stage. But certainly by the late 16th century, you're seeing young aristocratic Germans, for instance, with pocket watches on ropes hanging down from their necks. And at that time, because they were so inaccurate, as I say, it was very much more about display and ornamentation than anything else. And that carried on really all the way through until the present day. So whilst you have some watches that are being made more for utility, there's always been that trend of not necessarily ostentation, I suppose, but certainly of overt display and showing your wealth or your taste to other people.
What do you think in the sort of modern realm as both? I'm going to make an assumption here and assume that you really like watches.
I do quite like a watch, yes.
What do you think, I mean, both for you personally and for you as a retailer, what are the really sexy watches, do you think?
So for me, because I specialize in what I sell is vintage wristwatches. So we're talking 20th century, mainly from 1920 to about 1980. And for me, it's, it has to be a quality watch, first of all, but it's largely about condition of that watch and the way it's been designed. So for me, the most exciting thing is when you find, say, a watch from the 1940s that's hardly been used, but perhaps has got a little bit of patination to it, and it's just very little change from when it was produced. You've got, the idea of what the history of it is, and it's just a lovely object that you can wear. I mean, there's so few things that you can collect today that you can actually put on your wrist and wear out during the day. And it's, for me, it's not about, it's certainly not about the ostentation thing. It's like for vintage watch collectors who are buying the sort of beautiful, well-designed watches, it's slightly an in-club, I suppose. If you're with somebody else who knows about vintage watches and you're wearing a really beautiful one, they'll look at that and go, oh, that's really nice. They'll just know. But at the same time, somebody's not interested in watches, it won't necessarily look like anything special at all. So it's not like your big diamond set, bling, bling. it's not about showing off. It's about, I suppose it's more about taste in watches or something like that.
Being a bit classy.
Yeah, that sounds really snobby, doesn't it? But it's about enjoying things that are well made and look beautiful, but are not in your face. It's not about that. And they're not, these huge, great watches that you get today. It's much more subtle than that.
So that actually ties in quite nicely with one of my questions. So obviously I'm massively insecure and I constantly need validation, which is why I'm co-hosting a podcast. But I've got a very good friend of mine who's seriously into his watches. So he's always wearing something new and he's been collecting for years. So I'm looking for a watch that I can wear that will impress him, as somebody who's very much in the know, and you get that kind of, all I'm looking for is just that nod of approval from him of that passes muster, so to speak. So what would you recommend? Where should I look, or what types of things should I look at?
Well, I always think that the golden age of wristwatches, I think, is 1940s, 1950s, really. So you want to pick something very classic from that period. If money's no object, then go for like a Patek Philippe, like a very classic Calatrava from that period. That same look of that sort of watch can also be found in Amigas and Vacheron Constantin, Audemars Piguet. So there's all sorts of different brands where you can find, a similar sort of look, but at different price points. So it's accessible to most people. So you can pick up a beautiful watch, very classic, for a few £100. And if you're really going for it and you can do top of the range, then still a classic one you can, you know, spend a few thousand on and get something really lovely.
And when you're buying, say you're buying something from the 50s, is there, like, from a servicing perspective and kind of looking after the watch, is there anything you need to do? I'm a complete novice. So when I bought my Omega, I didn't realize, and this is, you know, it's a secret time, I didn't realize that it would stop, the time would stop if I stopped wearing it. So I picked it up one day and I had it like for about 2 weeks and the time had stopped and I thought I'd broken my watch. So I'm starting from a very low base. Which is, for anybody who's into watches, it's the most stupid thing in the world. I just assumed they were like digital watches and it just worked forever. But starting from that kind of base in terms of knowing nothing about watches, like, is there, do you need a watch winder? Do you need to,
keep them in a humidor?
Keep it like this, special servicing or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we're all out of practice now, aren't we? With, because certainly anyone who is born probably from 1970 onwards may never have had a mechanical watch. It's very different to having a quartz watch, in that, you know, the two main types of mechanical watches you get are manual wind or automatic. Automatic watches are sometimes called self-winding as well, which has always really confused me because it doesn't mean you're winding it. It means it's winding itself. So, first of all, the manual wind watch, normally they're daily wind and you have a power reserve, normally around 36 hours plus on it. So it's enough time over the 24 hours for you to remember to wind up your watch. And a lot of modern watches that are manual wind will have a longer power reserve than that. They'll, you know, often go maybe even for 2 days before needing a wind, but they'd still tell you to wind it every day. And then an automatic watch will wind itself as you're wearing it. They usually have a rotor that goes around the circumference of the watch, winds the main spring, has what's like a slipper spring inside to stop it from overwinding itself. And if you wear that all day, then, you know, every day, then it shouldn't stop. You know, as long as you're not sitting at a desk without moving your arm all day, because it does rely on you, you know, moving around a little bit. That's your two main types, really. And no, you don't need to have a watch winder. I mean, the watch winders, I always say, really are most useful if you've got a very complicated watch. So if you've got what's called a perpetual calendar, or indeed any calendar watch that's got, you know, maybe day, date, and month indication, you know, if you're not going to wear it every day, then of course it's a bore. If it's mechanical and it stops, you've got to reset up the calendar and everything again. Whereas if you put it on your watch winder and it's automatic, it'll wind it and then it'll be ready to go when you're next ready to wear it.
And isn't there big debates in the watch industry between people who are pro watch winders and people who are anti watch winders? Is that a real thing or have I just imagined it?
No, that is a real thing. You're quite right. Again, if you've got a vintage watch and it's an automatic vintage watch and it doesn't have a calendar on it or anything, I mean, I would normally advise people just to not worry about it. Don't put it on a watch winder and just, you know, because an automatic watch, you can always wind it a few turns to get it up and running again very quickly. And you don't really want to give something endless wear if you're not using it. So there's very little point in keeping it on a watch winder, really, in that case. So yes, that's what a lot of people would say against it. The thing for it is, particularly if you've, you know, you've got a rotation of say five or six watches that you wear regularly, that are automatic, and you know, you're changing them practically every day and you don't want the faff of setting the time on them and everything every time you take them out to wear them, then, you know, they're already set and going. So once you've got them on your winders.
That has just raised a question in my head, though, Alex. You were like, if you've got four or five watches which you wear regularly, and I thought, who's got four or five watches they wear regularly? And I thought, actually, Alex probably has. Yeah, How many watches do you own personally?
Quite a few. I probably wear about 10 fairly regularly in, you know, changing them around, and then a few others that get worn bit less regularly.
You don't like double them up or have one on each wrist or anything?
No, occasionally I've worn two, but more if I'm testing one than anything else.
The time's different in the other. Yes. On the other hand,
George Daniels, who some of your listeners will probably know, who's a very famous English watchmaker who died just a few years ago. He used to be a consultant at Sotheby's. He'd come in and he made his own incredible pocket watches and wrist watches, in fact, which fetch a lot of money these days because they're all handmade by him. But he was used to carry a pocket watch in his pocket, one of his own ones. He'd have a Rolex quartz gold watch on one wrist, and then often another watch as well, up his or whatever, just so that he could check the timings of his own watches that he'd made against the quartz ones. So, you know.
I that does raise another question though. Is it like if you asked somebody in the street about, you know, fancy schmancy expensive watches, Rolex is always going to come up. It's always going to be the first name that comes up in conversation with Joe Public. And I speak as a member of the public who doesn't know anything about watches. Is that a bit of clever marketing, or are Rolex, you know, top dog or one of the top dogs? Or is it like, I can't remember what the champagne brand is. The ubiquitous champagne brand. Moët & Chandon.
Yeah,
I probably just said that horribly. Sorry if I did. But, you know, I mean, I don't think anybody would ever say that's the best champagne you're ever going to taste. But it's the first one most people think of. Is Rolex equally kind of good watch and good marketing?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, they are exceptional watches, and they've been very clever right from the beginning. So Hans Wilsdorf, who founded the company back in the early 1900s, he was a very clever marketeer as well as, you know, being fascinated by watches. And he developed the brand and really put it on the footing to where it is today. And starting then, you know, that was still really pocket watch time. I mean, wristwatches really only started coming in the 1910s in any great numbers, you know, and it wasn't really till the 1930s where wristwatches overtook pocket watches in numbers produced and sold. And what the genius of Hans Wilsdorf was, with some small but very significant inventions and alterations that he made to early wristwatches. So he came up with the oyster case, which, you know, oysters almost as synonymous with the name of Rolex as their crown emblem. And the oyster case basically has a screw down winding crown, a screw down case back. And the first ones had also screw down bezel, which is the bit that holds the glass in the front. And that was to waterproof the watch and, you know, to make it much more robust. So you have to remember, of course, that, you know, the mechanical watch, certainly the early ones, were much more delicate, and it wasn't really made to be worn on the wrist. It was, you know, a pocket watch went in your pocket, and it was normally in one position for most of the day. When you think about the movement that's inside it, where you've got a balance oscillating 18,000 times an hour, you know, any knocks or bashes can affect that, and the timekeeping as a result. But also just in terms of moisture or dirt getting into a watch, that of course can cause its own problems, stopping it or, you know, damaging it, rusting it. And so the oyster case was a really good way of producing a wristwatch that you could wear that would be very protective to the movement. And, you know, eventually you could swim in or, you know, take in different climates, that sort of thing. That oyster thing really put them on the map in many ways. They then had an automatic movement that came out. And what you see today with Rolex, it's basically all about the oyster case Rolexes. So yes, lots of different models, but you'll see on those dials, Rolex Oyster. That's where all their success largely came from.
I did have a really good question and it's gone clean out of my head. So I'd like to apologize for that.
That's okay. I've just been stunned into silence by the price of the 1950s Patek Philippe's. I didn't think it'd be that expensive, but they are.
I've thought of my questionnaire, so thank you for that breathing space, Fintan.
That's okay.
In recent years, particularly with, and you can totally jump in and tell me I'm a knob here, Fintan, if you need to. In my humble opinion, the removal of the gold standard, tying sort of conventional currencies to anything in the real world, the relative instability of financial markets as a result, and currency trading as a result, and the ease of which it's manipulated. A lot of people have found that investing elsewhere in material things is wildly preferable. Comic books have had many famous examples of going through the absolute roof. Famous paintings, not so famous paintings. Whiskey is a massive one for investment as well. Watches, that is an area that people buy it as an investment, don't they? Is there anything that if somebody were looking today, where should they look if they wanted to invest in a watch? Not that's going to like give them a 3% return or whatever, but you know, that they can think, great, when I'm down on my luck and I need to buy drugs, I can sell that.
Well, yes, I mean, today the market's slightly complicated in that you have very different areas. So in modern watches, where the market is very, very hot for new Rolex, of course, at the moment. And as a lot of your listeners will know, if you go to a Rolex dealership and want a Rolex GMT Master, good luck. Get on the waiting list if you can. You'll be very lucky if you can. Or, you know, Daytona or anything else. It's very, very difficult to get a lot of these watches at the moment. Demand is far, far outstripping supply. Just to give one example, I had a customer the other day who wanted a Rolex GMT. Rolex retail price, I think, is £7,500. And to buy it from a reputable reseller, it's about £17,500. So you've got this sort of thing going on at the moment where if you're lucky enough to be able to get hold of a brand new Rolex, a lot of, certainly for the most popular brand new models, you can sell it on immediately for a huge profit, which must be A, very irritating for Rolex, but is B, very irritating for people who actually want to buy these things at the regular retail prices. So there's that end of the market. And then you've got the vintage end of the market where it's, you know, all about rarity, condition, quality, brand name, those sorts of things that come in. So, and the market is largely focused on Patek Philippe and Rolex. Those are the two really dominant names in the vintage market. And then
are there any up and comers that you can give us any tips about for Fintan, I mean?
Well, you know, Audemars Piguet and Vacheron Constantin have both been very collectible for many years as well, but their price points are tend to be quite a bit lower than Patek for most things, not everything. And then you have brands like Universal. It's a really interesting brand that made very beautiful watches. And then, you know, Amigas are, you know, still cracking value. Their prices have gone up a lot in recent years, but, you know, I think there's still an under appreciation of really how good their vintage mechanical movements were. I mean, I'm always surprised, but we sell a lot of vintage Amigas, and I'm always surprised at the accuracy that you can get from a watch that's 70 years old. Jaeger LeCoultre. I mean, there's all sorts of brands out there you can look at, but just in raw terms about what dominates the I suppose the investment side of the market, it's Patek and Rolex vintage wise.
So if I were going into a business meeting and I wanted to say very clearly, my Todger is the biggest Todger in this room, I want to go Patek Philippe or Rolex.
Basically, yeah. And if you're going in with a Patek, you're going in with a perpetual calendar chronograph. That's really showing you you've got some money and you've got some taste.
Sorry, I'm just writing that down. One sec. perpetual. Okay, yeah. All right, I'll Google it. All right.
And yes, otherwise you'll go in with or vintage wise again, if you're wanting to go out with a bang, then you go in with a Rolex Paul Newman Daytona, probably.
That is my favorite. That's the one I look at. You know the way, like when you were a kid, there was always that one toy in the shop window that you wanted and you'd like stare at it for hours. The Newman Daytona is the one I look at online quite a lot. I've got it bookmarked and I just look at it.
Yeah.
How much does that retail for, Fenton?
I haven't even, it's more, far more than I'll ever be able to afford on a watch. Alex, what's it? Because there's obviously there's the originals and then there's
the original Paul Newman Daytona. Yeah, I mean, well, we say original Paul Newman Daytona. Of course, they date to the 60s and 70s. Basically, they're named the Paul Newman Daytona because Paul Newman was seen to be wearing one. He's seen in one of the films, and his one famously sold, I think, maybe 3 or 4 years ago now, I can't remember exactly, something like $17 million in New York at an auction. But it wasn't tagged a Paul Newman at the time it was made by Rolex. It just happened that he wore one, so it became a nickname for it, effectively. So you had the standard Daytona line, and then this is called an exotic dial. That's what the Paul Newman dial is like. It's has these little squares and the subsidiary dials. That's the easiest way to identify them. And, you know, now they, I mean, when 20 years ago, you could have picked up a Paul Newman for £10,000 or something. And now you'd be lucky to get one less than £100,000.
That's astonishing appreciation.
Yeah. But that's not, now for the rare models, the vintage watch market has gone absolutely bonkers over the last, particularly the last 10 years, but certainly the last 20 years, excuse me. And it's still a relatively new market. I mean, the first vintage wristwatch auctions, for instance, began in really the early 1980s. There were some in the late 70s, but it really started going in the early 1980s. And you could, you know, just to give you some crazy examples, you could buy a Patek Philippe World Time, reference 2523, if you want to Google that, is a beautiful watch with a, they did a version with the blue enamel center. You could have bought one of those from Sotheby's in Geneva in 1984 for 6,000 Swiss francs. So that's about, well, in today's money, it's about £4,500. That same watch will cost you about 6 or 7 million Swiss francs today. So that's what, £4.5 million or something. Wow. That's appreciation. So unfortunately, had we all had the crystal ball back then, we'd be very rich.
Yeah, I wish I'd never asked for that Donkey Kong that Christmas.
So how do you, because obviously when there's so much money to be made, how do you protect yourself from fraud and fakes and these kind of things?
So, yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, obviously if you're going in to buy a very expensive vintage watch, you need to do your research. And if you're really coming into it fresh, then you need advice and guidance from somebody who knows what they're doing. Because, of course, there's a lot of funny stuff that goes on in the market, like there are in many different markets. But the good thing, again, about Patek is they, for instance, you can always go back to them and get what's called an extract from the archive. So even if the watch you're looking at doesn't have the original paperwork with it anymore, you can apply for it's basically a duplicate of what the archives at Patek say. So every single watch that Patek's ever made, there's an entry in their archive books for it. And with wristwatches, there's a different movement number to the case number. So it's, you know, very difficult for people to make up those numbers. And then they'll give you the certificate. It'll say what the dial was like and what metal the case is made from, what movement it's got in it, when it was made and when it was sold.
Fascinating. I didn't realize. So basically, there's a permanent record,
exactly,
available, yeah, for the higher end brands. That's amazing.
That's right. Some brands have more information than others on their books, but a lot of the high end brands, so Audemars Piguet, Vacheron Constantin, they'll also give you information from their archives for their watches if you request it. Rolex won't. You can't get any information out of them, unfortunately. And Rolex is the market for vintage-wise. You have to be particularly careful about. So, you know, going back to those Paul Newmans again, there's an awful lot of fake Paul Newmans out there. So, you know, it might be the whole watch is correct except for the dial, so the metal face of the watch, because, you know, you get the standard Daytonas and the Paul Newmans, and there's a big price difference between the two.
Ooh.
I would never even have thought about doing that. But then I'm not a career criminal, so I guess that would explain it. Fabulous. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really fascinating. I'm obviously never going to go into a meeting and, you know, well, I'm never going to impress anybody with my watch is what I'm trying to say.
I'm immediately going to follow up a critique about sponsoring the podcast. I think we need a new sponsor. I think this is definitely some gold.
There you are, then.
I think that's very forward thinking, and I wholeheartedly support you in that. I mean, good luck. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alex. That was brilliant.
And now it's time to welcome our third guest of the episode. It's award-winning journalist Rob Davis. Rob writes for The Guardian, the UK newspaper, and he's a business reporter. Rob, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Unfortunately, Fintan can't be on this section because he is giving a talk somewhere in Spain to, I don't know, some people, I guess. And as far as I'm aware, he doesn't speak Spanish, so who knows how that's going. Rob, got you here today and really very excited that you're here, because I have told you this before, but I'm a big fan. I wanted to talk to a specialist business journalist about the recent deal that Caesars did, and you know, most recently the sale of some of the assets that they bought last year to 888. And Fintan's going to be kicking himself that he's not here, because he's a big fan as well. The main thing that we wanted to ask you is, this looks like the deal of the decade, because Caesars did the deal probably about 12 months ago for, was it 2.5 billion, 2.7 billion to buy out William Hill assets. And they've just sold the non-US business for not much less than that, which just seems, it either undervalues the US business or overvalues the UK business. Is this the deal of the decade?
Yeah, I mean, you're making all the points that sort of came to my mind immediately. I saw the price tag on the sale of the non-US assets to 888. I mean, let's sort of factor in currency movements, right? The deal was $2.9 billion, so it was $3.7 billion, and that equated to £2.9 billion at the time. It now looks like $2.7 billion. So let's be kind to William Hill and say they got $2.9 billion, or they sold out at that price. Even so, it does look odd, doesn't it, that they're selling the non-US assets for not a great deal less. It sort of looks like William Hill shareholders sold on the cheap, really. And it looks even more that way when you look at what happened with Entain, formerly GVC, formerly Ladbrokes Coral, changed its name every 6 months, where they rejected a bid of $8 billion in January of this year from their joint venture partner, MGM Resorts. And you look at what they're valued on the stock market now, it's nearly twice that much. So I guess it shows that prices were only going in one direction, and perhaps holding out was the thing to do. I mean, the question is whether Caesars had William Hill over a barrel in some respects.
It's extraordinary, especially when, as you say, you factor in what happened with MGM and Entain, or didn't happen with MGM and Entain, and the valuations, because that it's not like that was happening in the background. You know, this has all kind of happened concurrently, and it's a little bit mind-blowing. If I were a William Hill shareholder, I'd be looking at this and thinking, hang on a second, lads.
I mean, I
we
think
might have gotten shafted here.
It's in moving early, right? So there weren't any other obvious comparators. There wasn't the Entain comparator when they started trying to do that deal. And they also had a huge advantage in that they already had a joint venture partnership with William Hill. And in the bidding war that was going on, it was Caesars versus this private equity outfit, Apollo. And Caesars essentially made it pretty clear that if Apollo won the bidding, then Caesars could quite easily tear up the joint venture agreement they had with William Hill. And that would have made William Hill a much less attractive prospect. So, you know, I don't want to use words like blackmail, but essentially Caesars Holding, which is, you know, for a Las Vegas casino operator is perhaps unsurprising. But it just feels like perhaps there's nothing else that William Hill shareholders and its board could really have done. But I mean, I think Caesars have been quite smart about this. And, you know, they've picked up, because all they're interested in, right, is sportsbook expertise. Because why risk developing all of that yourself when you've got one of the major players in an extremely mature market that's been doing this for 15 years? You just buy it in, right? So that's what they're doing. So that's hugely valuable to them. The potential value of the US market has only gone up since then. And I think they must just be pinching themselves on the bargain they got, presuming there are no sort of, I don't know, regulatory skeletons in the closet or, you know, or sort of IT gremlins lurking anywhere that they don't know about yet. But they seem smart enough that, you know, that none of that is likely to be lurking anywhere that they haven't seen already.
I mean, is it possible that the William Hill board could have predicted the way that this was going to go last year? I mean, is this a predictable chain of events?
Look, I don't know. Far be it from me to tell, you know, an experienced, well, not FTSE 100 anymore by the time they were sold, but an experienced FTSE director, you know, how to go about defending themselves against a takeover deal. And that's, of course, nobody can predict the future, right? Caesars is there with an offer on the table saying, look, you accept this, and if you accept a higher bidder from somebody else, then we tear up our lucrative joint venture arrangement. You know, it probably doesn't matter whether you can see the future. You're being presented with a reality in the present. You know, that's the hand they've been dealt. You know, I can understand it to a degree. I just think that Entain shareholders will be sitting looking at that thinking, well, we stand to do rather well out of having invested in Entain rather than William Hill, if that's something that they've done.
Well, if Entain keeps going the way that it is, it might be them buying MGM before too long.
Right, exactly. You know, nothing would surprise me anymore. I mean, you know, Flutter seem to be the ones who've done the real kind of transatlantic mega deal, and they're just this absolutely huge player now. You know, you wonder whether Entain could do something similar, whether it's a merger or even a buyout of one of the US players. Because at the moment, it just looks like America's looked at some tasty assets in the UK and just thought, well, you know, why do we want to work with these people? Why don't we want to share the spoils? Let's just buy our limey cousins, and then we don't have to worry about, you know, making nice with them anymore. And we all make a lot of money. It would be interesting if, you know, essentially a UK company could flex its muscles and show a little bit of gumption, a little bit of ambition in the opposite direction. I don't know how realistic it is.
Well, do you know what? Something that will affect whether or not that happens is, and this would not have affected Caesars if Caesars were in this position right now. Caesars has no exposure in Asia at all. Mm. Okay. Specifically Macau. Obviously, you've seen what's happened with MGM basically overnight, with the share price being massively affected by the mooted rules by Chinese government on licenses, etc., in Macau. And MGM would be hugely, hugely affected by that. I mean, MGM and Wynn as well would both be, you know, and as soon as an announcement like that comes out, and I think the news came out very early this morning, then share prices do tumble, well, do and have tumbled. And yes. So it does leave somebody like MGM vulnerable.
Yeah, and I guess and makes them less able to do a takeover deal themselves, right? If they're paying for any of it in shares, which I think at 15, 16 billion, which is Entain's stock market value at the moment, maybe they would have to do. I wonder if that puts the kibosh on reviving the takeover in that direction anyway. It's an interesting one. You know, there's been so much consolidation in the sector in the past 5 to 10 years. And we are seeing these global players emerge, aren't we? I mean, I wonder if there's also a question about whether there are any last remaining skeletons in the closet at Entain as well, right? Because there's still an ongoing HMRC investigation into them operating in Turkey, isn't there, that I don't think has been resolved. And I know, you know, US regulators and the Department of Justice and so on take a pretty dim view of that kind of thing. So there's danger there for any potential buyer. But I suppose that obviously didn't put MGM Resorts off first time around. Maybe it wouldn't put them off again. And it's all very much up in the air, isn't it? I mean, I certainly wouldn't like to predict these deals. And if I could predict these deals, I probably wouldn't be a news reporter. I'd be a millionaire.
Well, you could be a millionaire news reporter. I mean, the two things are not mutually exclusive. Look at your colleagues. The other, well, MGM, obviously, their Macau venture is with Pansy Ho. And I remember, I think it was when Boston Harbor, I think, was, I don't think they'd even broken ground on it yet, but the regulator said, actually, we're not sure you can have a license for this state because you've got a business dealing with Pansy Ho. And as far as I'm aware, Pansy Ho's cleaner than clean and incredibly smart and successful woman. But MGM then said, OK, well, we won't build it then, because Macau is that much more important. And it wouldn't be out of the question for them to try a similar flex with Entain. But one thing I did want to ask you, once a takeover has been attempted, there's a period where it can't be attempted again, right?
Well, depending on the way they arrange the takeover and various other caveats about, you know, agreement from shareholders and so on. But yeah, essentially, yeah.
Does that go both ways?
Oh, that's a good point. I don't think so. And anyway, I mean, that period is up now anyway with the Entain deal, right? That expired in mid-July, I think it was.
Oh, okay. So, I thought that was still on.
They could have come back if they wanted to. I mean, I imagine they're probably sitting there looking at the rising share price, feeling pretty sick. But who knows?
One other thing I did want to ask you about, Rob, while we've got you here, the new head of the Gambling Commission, because I know gambling is one of your sort of beats for the Guardian. I don't know about you. I don't know anything about this new dude at all. And you know, it wouldn't surprise me if you didn't either, because he just seems to have come totally out of left field from what I can see. But
yeah.
What are your thoughts on do you have any thoughts on the appointment? But also, do you have any thoughts on the appointment in the context of the gambling review?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about the guy, right? He sort of spent a long time at Deloitte, the management consultancy, and I think he's sort of involved in various different public sector reform projects. And, you know, he's obviously got a big brain for figures and detail. And, you know, that seems like he'd be well placed to lead a regulator, if that's the case. His predecessor was an ex-lawyer, wasn't he, I think? Although, you know, you can argue about whether or not he did a good job. It's an interesting one, because I think there was an article in, I think it was the Telegraph, where they essentially said it was down to a short list of three names, and Marcus Boyle, who got the job, was not one of those three names. And when that article came out, I got in touch with a source of mine in Westminster and said, is this right? And they sort of said, don't believe everything you read, which made it pretty clear to me that it wasn't any of the three people on that list. But they wouldn't tell me who had got the job. I had a fourth name who I thought might get it. And the reason I thought they might get it is that they came to me ahead of their interview and said, what should I say in my interview? that person also didn't get it, which maybe that's a good thing, because if you're asking me what you should say in your interview, perhaps you're not cut out for the job. But in the end, we've got this guy. I mean, look, he's coming in. You could say it's either a lose-lose or a win-win situation, because essentially we're in the process of the review is already underway. The Gambling Commission is going to have some role in that. But essentially, let's be realistic about this. Ministers are going to decide what they want to do, and the Gambling Commission is going to do what it's told. Right. So he's essentially a passenger in that process. He's not associated with or tainted by any of the previous failures of the Gambling Commission. So he just sort of has to sit there and be told what the new landscape is and then implement it. And, you know, there's going to be a grace period while everyone's figuring out how the new regulation is going to work. In the meantime, the entire industry, I mean, online in particular, are on their absolute best behavior, right? You know, there's probably never been so many responsible gambling checks, I would bet, as if there are going on at the moment. So I don't know. I think he's in quite a good position, or you could say it's lose-lose, because essentially, you know, he hasn't got anything he can really do. So it depends what you want out of a job, I suppose.
It's pretty fair summing up, and it's exactly what I thought. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to have you.